Oh, we're official now. All righty.
Maybe we could ask our audience just to come sit with us. We ready?
All right. I'd like to call the Complaints Committee meeting to order. And then we'll go around the room just for the record to say who's here. And we'll start with, I'm John Hartley. I'm chairman of the Complaints Committee.
Joseph Rogan, Ethics Commission.
Carla Miller, director.
Kirby Eberdorfer, deputy director.
Okay, the reason for our meeting today is the proposed amendments to the Ethics Commission complaint procedures. And Joe's been heading that up, so I'll let him go ahead and get started of explaining what he's done so far.
Fantastic. So for the tape, we're missing our GC liaison and Ellen, so we're in workshop right now. I have here a summary, which even in executive form is about 5 pages long. Do you mind giving one to Kirby? And what I've done here is gone through the more significant changes. There are changes that are not in here, and there are relatively minor changes that are in here, but these were just the highlights that I thought are worth going through. It's not going to be a good use of anybody's time to go line by line through the amendments. It's essentially a rewrite, and so going line by line through the amendments just doesn't work. However you guys, John and others, however you think is most effective to go through this and explain it, the very large-scale items that we've talked about a number of times are the bifurcation of the commission. Awesome.
There she is. Ellen Schmidt just walked in the room, so she's part of our committee.
That's okay. We just got started.
Here comes Cherry.
And there she's off.
Good. And you can regavel us in official meeting.
And Ellen needs one of these, too.
Yeah.
And Cherry.
One for Ellen, one for Cherry, and if anybody else shows up and wants one, I have even more.
And with the arrival of Ellen, we now have a quorum at 5:04.
Calling us an official meeting then?
Yes, this will be we were in, what did you call it before?
Workshop.
Workshop. We're going from workshop to an official complaints committee meeting.
Awesome.
So Joe can continue.
Okay, so what you have in front of you is as short of an executive summary as I could prepare on the changes to the complaint procedures. As I just said in workshop, it's really a rewrite, and so it's just not an effective thing to go through it line by line and talk about all the changes. I've spent more than a full working day with Carla and Kirby incorporating multiple rounds of these edits, at least 3 rounds of full edits from the Echo office, and another 20 or more hours on my own working on this. So it's in a form now that I think is ready for presentation to this committee. I haven't heard any feedback yet from OGC, but if you have any, love to hear it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And happy to go through this in whatever order makes sense. We can go through the summary. We can just talk generally, however you think is useful.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I got it from Carla late Thursday night. So you guys have, like you stated, you spent enormous amount of time on it. I kind of looked at it over the weekend and made a couple of changes as well. And I can go by line as well as to what the changes that I made. And I also talked with the general counsel and deputy general counsel. And we would really respectfully ask for additional time to look over it because it truly is a rewrite. And so OGC is not prepared to, OGC would just like more time so that we can be more supportive of the changes, the significant changes. So we'd just like to look at it a little more, that's all. And then if we can provide support.
Carla?
I just wanted to say I talked with General Counsel's office today about this, and we are presenting this in advance, 10 days in advance, so that we comply with the rules so that we can bring it to the whole commission. It doesn't say you present it 10 days ahead and then nobody can have any ideas in that 10-day time period. So Kirby and I will work with Cherry in the next couple of days prior to the full Ethics Commission meeting, and we'll hammer out like a lot of these different things so that maybe we might have one or two suggestions, two or three, by the time we get to the final commission meeting, but we'll work together and make sure that we're all on the same page.
Yeah, and Carla and I did speak earlier, and I did tell her what OGC is. It's right now what we're feeling right now, especially I guess we need to talk more about the bifurcation. Obviously, that's a big change, and so we wanted to talk more with Carla about that. And
So that makes sense. I think Carla's right, and to the extent there is some issue with the 10-day requirement, the full commission can waive that, because that's just a requirement that's in the rule itself, and so the commission can waive that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but the concept of this, I think we've talked about ad nauseum, both in this committee and in the full commission. I don't think a single commission member expressed any issues with the concept of bifurcation. There is one tweak to that Kirby raised that's a really interesting point. The basic concept of this was to split into the complaints committee and the hearing panel. That's what I've called them. Right. We can change those names and call it whatever you want, but the concept is you have an investigatory body and an ultimate decision-making body. That's how a lot of state and local organizations who have been successful have done it, and I think that incorporate some lessons learned from some other local ethics commissions who have run into trouble with trying to handle all the stages as a full commission. The only thing that under the code we can't handle in bifurcated, what I'm calling divisions, that's the term I've used in the amended rules, is the divisions. The only thing you can't handle in divisions is self-initiation, because under the code that has to go to the full commission and requires a vote of at least 6 members. So other than self-initiation, everything else under the rules as I've drafted them is handled on divisions. Mm-hmm. There's one interesting policy question about that Kirby raised and is worth discussing. I didn't really express a strong opinion either way with it to the ECHO office, is when you come to dismissals, the way I've drafted the rules, which is the same way that the Judicial Qualifications Commission, which punishes and can recommend removal of state judges in Florida, works, is that when the matter is pending before the complaints committee, which is any time before a probable cause finding. So anytime you're in executive session, pre-probable cause finding, you're in front of the complaints committee. The complaints committee, under the rules as I've written them, can dismiss the complaint under Rule 17, which is the rule that says basically public interest and settlement, all those other reasons. And Rule 17 has been used a lot by this commission to dismiss complaints. So under the rules as I've written them, pre-probable cause finding, the complaints committee can unilaterally dismiss under Rule 17. It's the same way the JQC works. The hearing panel, right, our remaining colleagues get no say in that decision. And so if we choose to dismiss it, it's non-reviewable. That's final action of the commission. And similarly, we could find by unanimous vote probable cause. So the four of us, when Brian's here too, we could say this needs to go forward. This is a real complaint. Find probable cause, and the hearing panel could immediately call it up and dismiss it under Rule 17. Right. So it allows that, and the JQC I think has experienced some success in that regard because it's sort of a check and balance. If we happen to be too much leaning toward prosecution, the hearing panel can balance us out, and vice versa. So I like it this way, but I'm not strongly wed to that. If you guys have different views. Kirby's, the idea she just threw out there, I think, to think about as kind of opposing views, we can do it the way it's written right now. The other way is you can have dismissal decisions reviewed by the full commission. The only issue I see with that review by the full commission is you run into the same problem you had right now, which is, let's say we vote as a complaints committee 3-1 to dismiss under Rule 17. The hearing panel overturns that and kicks it back to us and says, no, you need to continue on and find probable cause. What are the chances that person actually thinks they're getting a fair hearing now?
Right.
After the hearing panel, who's actually going to decide their case, just reversed our decision to dismiss the complaint.
Well, wouldn't that be final decision of the commission if they reverse it and so the person is not found in violation? So why would it go back to the probable cause committee?
So the only time that we're talking about right now for review would be a decision to dismiss. So if the complaints committee says, we don't think it's in the public interest to proceed with this complaint, so we're going to dismiss under Rule 17A. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me on that. Look at that. So the complaints committee says under Rule 17A, it's not in the public interest to continue. So under Rule 17A, we're going to dismiss 3-1 or 4-0. The hearing panel, so then that's reviewed by the full commission to decide if to dismiss. So then the full commission votes 5-4, right, with all of us again voting to dismiss and all of our hearing panel colleagues now voting to overturn that dismissal. And so they have to send it back to the four of us who said it should be dismissed and say continue on and find probable cause.
So the only thing that I would add to what Joe said, as we were discussing about the complaints committee, Joe had made, I thought, an appropriate observation that the complaints committee shouldn't really be staffed of equal number of commission members. So ideally it might be three. And so it gave me pause for concern that a third of the commission would be deciding to dismiss something in finality without bringing it to the remainder of the commission. That was my concern. So what I proposed to Joe was perhaps having review by the full commission, but requiring two-thirds of the commission to overturn the decision. In other words, the decision would stand unless two-thirds. So it would require additional people. Not the whole hearing panel itself couldn't flip it. It would require other people to do that. So. Right.
To the full commission, yeah. And that seems more acceptable. But I also wanted to just describe that when I worked for the Attorney General's office like almost 18 years ago, so we represented these boards and commissions, Board of Medicine. It's been so long. Board of Medicine. You have practitioners. And they also would be accused of violation of their state laws there as well. And I distinctly remember, you know, chiropractors, dentists, nurses going before a probable cause panel, which was a committee of the full nurses, social workers board. And once they either found probable cause or not, that it would go to the full board, right. And that's how it's always been. And so that's why I thought that I had never seen a bifurcation, set up the way you have, and especially with the Administrative Procedures Act, it's always been set up as the probable cause. There's a committee. The full board actually is charged with final action. But I do like what Kirby is suggesting, that at least it will come back. And that's what OGC's concern is, that the full commission has to make the final decision.
I think there's sort of two things in there, so let's try to separate those out.
All right.
The first is the concept of bifurcation.
Okay, you're right.
And as to that, that's a policy question. And before I underwent this effort, I think I have unanimity of my colleagues that we're going to bifurcate. Unless a majority of my colleagues change what they've already said, I think that's the route we're going. And I certainly hope I didn't waste 20 hours, because that's the whole concept of these rules. If we go back on bifurcation, we might as well throw this out. So I think we're past that for the concept of bifurcation. It's just a policy question. There are boards that do it the way you're describing, where you can delegate the probable cause finding, but then ultimately you go to the full panel. And then there are boards that bifurcate, like the JQC. And so it's just a policy question. I think my view is strongly that there's a real appearance of conflict when your complaints committee or whoever is finding probable cause, who's directing the investigation, right? So we're directing Carla and or Kirby to go find information, figure out if there's probable cause. The respondent has a right to be heard in executive session before the finding of probable cause. So they come before the committee. The committee hears them and says, nope, legal sufficient. Not only is it legally sufficient, you've met the pleading standards as they're outlined, and therefore there's probable cause. But now we're going to take a step back, and we're going to be completely neutral and hear all the evidence on the final hearing panel. And so that's just a policy question. I hear what you're saying. I think that's the counter argument, and it's a good argument. but that's just a policy question. And then the second part of that is as to this specific decision of dismissal, even to make it to illustrate Kirby's point one step farther, it's not even a third of the commission, right? It's two members. So if the complaints committee is three, the complaints committee could vote 2-1 to dismiss. And so essentially two members of the nine-member commission can constitute final action and dismiss a committee. And that's a problem. I'm not saying it isn't. But the balance is you erode the concept of bifurcation and you make the hearing panel look less objective if you allow them to review. So that's the balance. There's pros and cons of each. So the pros of having full bifurcation is that the hearing panel is totally independent. They hear things for the first time in an adversarial setting, because we are a quasi-judicial board in this regard. They hear things for the first time in a in an adversarial setting, presented as the parties would present them. So that's that side of it. But the counterpoint, as Kirby raised, is you risk that two members of the complaints committee could say we should let this go, and that's it. So now there's some control in there because the chair of the commission appoints the complaints committee, so and could remove somebody for any reason at any time. So if the first couple meetings were going kind of weird, a chair would be fully in their discretion to say, Joe, why don't you come? Why don't you go handle internal operations, and we're going to have, Dr. Candler handle complaints.
Well, let me throw this out. Like, most of our cases get dispensed with early on. They don't go to the big probable cause official hearing officers. We never get that far. So wouldn't it be better to have the complaints committee be comprised of more people, like five people, for instance, and then you have the bulk of the people really discussing the investigation and working it out with a settlement and whether or not it needs to be dismissed. And then if it goes past that, we have at least three people that could be on the final hearing. And a lot of those cases, if it's that contested, we would probably be referring it out to an official hearing officer. And just let that, and then you only have the board of three people of the commission do the tail end of it, because most of our work is going to be at the front end. So we'd have more people participating, like five people on the complaints committee.
Let me throw this out there. If you, notwithstanding my comments to Kirby discouraging an even number, if you put four people on complaints, you accomplish the same goal, because it takes three to take action, right? So three is a majority of four, obviously. So if you have a four-member complaints committee, in effect, you're requiring the same amount of votes as if you had a five-member committee, but you still allow the majority of the commission to sit in the full adversarial context, which in my view is where the respondent needs the most due process protection. They're really, in the probable cause, the executive session, it's a pretty low standard. And although we've never found probable cause, the vast majority of the time this commission is dismissed under Rule 17, whether they've expressly said so or not. They're not making a finding of probable cause, they're just dismissing for under Rule 17 A or B.
Which is consistent with, I think, the theory that if we could have the Ethics Commission move more towards settlements, resolving things, working with the person, training, doing it at that end is better than having full-fledged probable cause determinations and then lawyers coming in and everybody arguing and taking it on. I mean, if we get into a more legalistic proceeding, then we're going to be... It would be very strange after 20 years that all of a sudden we would end up doing that.
This
because
certainly we're doing this for the exception to the rule. This would be the far outside of what we've seen.
Exactly. And so I'd like to just intersperse some comments that, first of all, I wanted to thank Joe, because our first round with doing these rules was with Kirby about 10 years ago when she was on the Ethics Commission. And so now she's here to take a look. And I thought, wow, someone that can jump in and spend this amount of time and really, because I am just in awe of people that can sit down with the rules and do this type of thing. So thank you very much. A brilliant job. Truly well done. And I was just reading before I came down, and I'll send it to Cherry, a book on national best practices with ethics commissions. Bifurcating is obviously where we want to go to ensure due process. And so I think we're definitely on the right track. We've got like 98% of it here in front of you. I just have a few comments, maybe about like six things that if we could revise them quickly, I don't think they're complicated at all. If we could do that, then this draft would be, in a touch better position to send to the entire commission. So if I can just raise a few points here.
Go ahead and do that.
You know.
Is there any, do you guys have any comments on what we've been talking about so far?
We've, like you said, we're beating a dead horse here. We've already, the entire commission, we've talked about this, and I think I made you talk about it a couple of times. So, because I had to get it straight in my mind, and I think I understand it now. So certainly this is the exception to the rule, and it could come up, and if it did, we want to do it right. And so thanks for jumping out and getting this done. So this all completely makes sense to me now, and I think it makes sense to the whole group. And as long as we can get the general counsel on board, I think that we'll get this done. So
okay.
Probably makes sense to go ahead. Let's get going on the parts that we need to go through.
Very quick.
And then we can go back and discuss this again.
Yeah, and let me tell you, living with these rules for the last 20 years, you never get them perfect, because whatever you do, someone will come in and there will be one rule you wish you would have done a little differently. I mean, it's just like a never-ending process. Okay, I think we're all looking at the same draft. Page one, let's see here. Yeah, page one, it's rule one, B, jurisdiction. And I would say...
So this says page five?
Yes.
Okay.
Page five.
Mm-hmm.
The wording in the original rules, I think, is a little bit tighter. It talks about issue findings with regard to any sworn written complaint alleging a violation of Chapter 602. And we don't have jurisdiction to receive any sworn complaint. It has to be connected to Chapter 602. It's superfluous language, really, kind of, but
yeah.
I think it's a little clearer that written and 602, if we can just add that.
Yeah, let's sort of, so we can, in the interest of time,
yeah.
The definition of sworn complaint is that it otherwise complies with the rule, which requires that it be signed and comply with Rule 5B. And so all those requirements are incorporated,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to be adding superfluous language back in that we've removed.
I don't think, I looked at 5B, and I don't think it states that. And I looked at the definition of sworn complaint.
Well, you know what? The thing is, I like it if it's really in clear, plain English, and even if it is a touch redundant to say it needs to be a written complaint under 602, it's on the very first page. It's clear. People can focus on it, and you know what I mean? It takes out any doubt. You don't have to look at two or three other provisions in order to interpret.
What is the change you're proposing?
Just a sworn written complaint. It can't be.
You
it
want
has to be.
My copy says sworn written complaint. So
that's the current rule. You're looking at the current rule, not the proposed amendments.
And you want to change it to
I want to keep it the same as it was originally.
Do you have a copy
which is
of the proposed amendments?
Yes, it's in the packet in front of her, and we sent it out.
No.
That's just
a summary.
Jurisdiction.
Okay.
So you have two things. Kirby sent out two, the current rules that
okay.
we currently are operating under,
right.
and then the last revised
okay.
draft, Joe 3 or Joe 2. I don't know.
Five, I think. Six.
Joe 8. And so
it's not this. It's actually, it should be in here somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll find it yet. I'm just suggesting we just make it clear. It's
yeah.
it's not.
Sworn complaint is a defined term, so I'm fine with it as written. I don't know if obviously my colleagues can disagree with me or my thought, but my thought is I don't want to become superfluous in these, because then we could go in everywhere it says the code and say Section 602, Jacksonville Code of Ordinances, just to be clear. But we've defined sworn complaint as being a complaint that is signed by the complainant under oath, otherwise in compliance with Rule 5B. 5B means that it has to be, it has to meet all the technical requirements of the code. So to be a sworn complaint, it has to be a written complaint signed under oath and meets the requirements under Rule 5B.
Yeah, I don't think 5B is explicit enough, and I think we'd run into problems with that. So if we just say sworn complaint means a complaint initiated by the receipt of a complaint, which is signed by under oath,
Whether you change it in jurisdiction or whether you change it in 5B, I mean, you're looking to have that written put back in there.
Plain English. So that you don't have to look at sworn complaint definition, then you have to look at 5B definition, and you put them all together.
How many times is that in there, I wonder? Sworn.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
I mean, if we want to be super clear, we could make these rules three times this length. Uh-huh. And everywhere it says the code could say, in compliance with Section 602 Jacksonville, you know, Code of Ordinances.
Yeah, I think that it's probably the definition of sworn complaint referencing 5B, because I don't think, if you have to go two, three steps in order to get a definition of something, I think it's confusing. So maybe complaint under oath and...
I mean, the jurisdiction is what it is, right? So the jurisdiction statement could say the commission shall have jurisdiction for all matters under the code. It could be that simple.
Per 602.
To handle all matters under the code.
Per 602.
Take out everything.
Yes.
The commission shall have jurisdiction as described in the code, which is defined as Section 602.
Yeah, I like that. That's clear, and then we don't. Okay, that's fine. And then.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Under subsection A, enabling law, and then you insert it regardless of the date of filing after, as of the date of these rules are adopted, they shall govern disposition of all ethics complaints regardless of the date of filing. So you insert it regardless of the date of filing. I mean, isn't that assumed already that, you know, as soon as you file an ethics complaint that, you know, regardless of when it's filed, I mean, unless you're referring to at the time now that we're rewriting these rules, that perhaps there may be some complaints that come in during the rewriting, or
so what we're
is that what you're
what we're contemplating trying? in 1A, and this was rewritten with our ethics officers here. What we're contemplating in 1A is that both this amendment and future amendments, so that respondents are on notice that the amendments could apply to their complaint even if already filed.
Okay, so if they already, right. If we already have some
filed.
There's
a complaint right now that's in executive session, this is right. Going to control how we process that complaint.
I kind of figured that, but I'm like, is it really necessary though? I mean, isn't that obvious?
I hope that would be obvious. I accepted that suggestion from my colleagues.
I know
who
you
want to write in plain
okay.
English.
Oh, well, then I guess the question is projected to
more than
Kirby
obvious. The two that are more than obvious.
So I'm fine taking that out. I think
I just didn't think it was necessary. But okay.
It's clear. I mean, it doesn't affect anything one way or the other. It's clear. I'll tell you the reason why some of this stuff comes in is because Kirby and me to a longer time period, I have to listen to people ask all these questions. So if there's something that can make it clear that I can point to instead of giving the legal interpretation of it, it helps me. It just, even if it sounds
so
simple.
It's come up as an issue before?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, so anyhow. So the next one is down, if you look at 1C, complaints committee, this is just a small, like halfway in, it says the complaints committee can do a bunch of stuff, and then they can submit a sworn complaint to the hearing panel. And we, of course, have defined sworn complaint here, but we also have the self-initiated complaints. So the complaints committee can send a sworn complaint, or they can also do a self-initiated complaint. Do you think that your definition of sworn complaint incorporates self-initiated because it references 5B?
And also in Rule 8, 9, which self-initiation rules? 8 or 9?
I think it's 8.
In the self-initiation rules, it says that once the full commission votes by 6 members to initiate a sworn complaint, that complaint is now treated like any other sworn complaint. Mm. So once the chair or the whoever the senior officer is voting in favor of self-initiation signs the sworn complaint, that's now a complaint like any other complaint. So that now goes back to the complaints committee to handle as a sworn complaint. And if they find probable cause, they actually send the self-initiated complaint to the hearing panel
right.
to decide.
Got it. Okay.
Well, you guys know these things, huh?
So the advocate, and this is a little bit, this is stylistic,
yeah. Okay.
But the advocate, if you think about it, has to be either a volunteer member of the bar or a member of the Office of General Counsel other than Cherry. So although when the rules were first written, my interpretation of them was that it was contemplating either Carla or Cherry, or the person who was sitting in their roles at the time, well, Carla was there at the time, would act as investigator, but that really can't happen because we need Carla's advice,
right.
and Cherry's advice. So we need your advice. So you really can't act as advocate.
Right. It would be sort of like how the Civil Service Board is
exactly.
run now. They have an attorney that advises the board, and then we have attorneys that are defendant.
Right.
So
so okay. my thought was, how am I going to get a member of the bar to agree to do this for free? And I'm not going to do that by calling them advocate. So we changed advocate to, first I changed it to special counsel, which is the term that the JQC uses. Carla then brought up the great point that sounds a lot, we might as well just call him prosecutor at that point. And so we changed it to special ethics counsel. But really it was just a change in term to make the position, frankly, more attractive to get a good lawyer like Braxton or somebody who would agree to do it. It's really that simple.
So we still have the function. It's just called something different. Okay, the next thing.
Oh, I'm sorry, but do we have a definition? Under Complaints Committee, and you mentioned this earlier, Joe, about you wanted to call it a division of the commission as opposed to a subcommittee. So do we want to define division?
Oh, boy.
I think that that's self-explanatory. Division?
Yeah. I pulled it from the JQC rule, but let me think.
It's just that there's divisions in the whole city government as well. So I just, you know, and they have their meanings in the code. So I'm just,
it's really a fair point. But I mean, in my view, is tainted, you know, by my experience. But in my view, a division of the commission is sort of a self-explanatory phrase. But
well, then it goes a little bit further, and it says what they're to do. So it says a division that is vested to do this. So whoever appoints the committee chairman, and then the committee members vest them to do this. So it's a division to do this, not just a division.
So it sounds like you're okay with it as written.
I'm okay with that. After reading it, I mean that. Said just a division of the
commission, period.
Right, period. Yeah, make a lot of sense. Division of the committee vested with the jurisdiction to receive complaints.
All right.
And I'll tell you, when Kirby and I went over these in detail, and we'll set some time to really go over them with Cherry too, there were a lot of really interesting points that both of us made, and I thought, what really has to be done now to get the show on the road and get this done? And we can always come back in January and February and fine-tune even more.
Right.
And as soon as we have one person run through this, we'll want to fine-tune anyhow because new things always come up. So it's sort of like the perfect being the enemy of the good. You know, like this is beyond good. This is excellent.
Right.
So anyhow, the few points I think are, if you go to in the definitions, ex-party communication, again, this I just wanted it to be clear. Ex-party communications, means like you're hearing it and the attorney comes and just talks to you on the phone, calls you at home at night, you know, and they want to influence you. Clearly, we don't want that kind of ex-party communication on. But this occurs outside of the executive session, and I wanted to maybe clarify that this does not cover ECHO staff or OGC staff, like the three of us sitting here,
yeah.
That obviously, and it may be implied somewhere else, but I wanted it to be clear in the definition that it, not us.
So okay. I think here's the way to look at this. I thought about that a lot after seeing Kirby's comment, and I agreed wholeheartedly with it. That is an ex parte communication. But let me give me 1 second before you say anything to that. So communication between a decision maker, so I added that back in, that was one of Kirby's suggestions, that was great. So it has to be a communication with a decision maker relative to a matter before the body. So a communication between me and Carla or me and Cherry about a matter pending before the commission is an ex parte communication. But if you go to Rule 15, it is not an ex parte communication that requires disclosure.
I find that confusing.
It is a little weird.
because people will question that. I always think of, how am I going to train people on this? And if it doesn't jump out. So I think that ex-party communications, if we could put some sentence in there saying, although it's an ex-party communication, under the clear definition of the word, that doesn't mean that you can't talk to OGC staff and ECHO staff. I don't know how we do that, because I saw that you excluded it in 15 from a reportable one, but that's going to confuse Ethics Commission members. They're going to go, oh, my God, this is ex-party. This is wrong, and then they're not going to talk to us.
That's a fair point, and I was thinking about in a court, right? So as lawyers, if we talk to a judge without opposing counsel, it's an ex-parte communication. But then there's a separate analysis of, do I then have to disclose that communication? So that's the way I was thinking about it, but I agree with you. It does seem pretty legalistic.
How about if we stick it in Rule 15? We still define it as ex parte, but we say, we make it a – it should really – disfavored, I don't know. We should put a section in there, and Kirby and I can draft something up saying that although it is an ex parte communication, you are allowed to talk with OGC staff and ECHO staff. Just something simple there, because I know –
Well, let me first address that and then talk about the broader point. So that would be great if you guys could think of a way to do that. My thought would be to throw it in. I like your first idea, to actually put it in the definition. And you could say there, I mean, just be clear. Although technically an ex parte communication, nothing in these rules should be read to prohibit communications between commission members, the Office of Ethics, Compliance, and Oversight, or the Office of General Counsel. But let me stop that for a second, because I'm thinking about how the procurement process works in other divisions of the city, and a lot of times those communications are ex parte. And so JEA, for example, the only person those decision makers can talk to that's not ex parte is their legal counsel, who is Jody. I always get that wrong. Jody. That's the only person they can talk to. They can't talk to their staff members. That's an ex parte communication. Now here that's a little different, because, well, it's funny that you're both lawyers. That may not always be the case, but right now you're both lawyers. So what do you guys think? My inclination, while thinking that maybe that's not totally consistent with how other divisions of government do it, that it's best to exclude that in the definition.
I mean, I think any time you can include, we always look for advice from Kirby and Carl and Cherry. So that's worth to be added in there, because we do rely on you guys. So anything that is swayed that is not good for being in here.
Yeah.
How about if we draft something up and just present it at the meeting and see what you think of it? All three of us will think of something.
Yeah. And then as a policy matter, I guess, I mean, how do you look at this? Because do we want – should the public expect that we're not consulting with people off the record? Or is this the same as a judge who talks to their law clerk or their judicial assistant or their colleague?
I think making it clear in the definition would help. Somebody like me, not an attorney, understand better the expectation and not panic if Carl calls me at home at night.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Okay.
I know that we had talked about I wanted to go back to the complaints committee in the last sentence. The definition of the complaints committee: decisions within the authority vested in the complaints committee under these rules constitute final orders of the commission and are not reviewable by the full commission. Does that include the suggestion by Kirby, or
so
is that something that you guys are sticking to?
So that's a good point. I meant to go back to that. I understand that there's a risk in full bifurcation, but my just sort of policy view on this is that we either need to bifurcate or not. And so if we're going to bifurcate, let's bifurcate. There shouldn't be a review by the full commission in that sense. Now, the chair has the discretion to put however many people he or she wants on the complaints committee. You could make it a 7-member committee if you want, or 5-member committee, or 4-member committee, or 3-member, whatever. That's going to be up to the chair.
And I've heard. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
So you're this is a go. Well, in concept. so you struck action as opposed to fight, and then put in final orders.
Yes. Yeah, so that comes from the code itself, and the provision on the code.
The code
says,
I thought, said final action.
So if it does, then it should go back. But I had action check the code And I thought in the provision that talks about circuit court review, it says that final orders of the commission are
reviewable. Yeah, it does say that in the for appellate.
That this is the kind of order.
You're right about that. It does, so that it needs to probably be consistent then. But in the code, there's other parts of the code that says final action. So I've seen that. And so all you're doing is just trying to make it consistent with what's in the code.
I want it to be clear. So here's what I want. I don't want a respondent or complainant, for that matter, if they think their rights have been violated. But usually we're talking about a respondent, right?
Right.
I don't want somebody who gets an order from the complaints committee to then request review by the commission and then miss their deadline to file a petition for writ of cert. So I want this rule to be super clear that when you get an order from the complaints committee, it's over.
Mm-hmm. But the order should state that right to appeal in the order, so they will know that they will go to circuit court.
Also be in the order, yeah.
Yeah, so that's how most orders are. It states that you can appeal this to the circuit court or whatever body that you're going to appeal it to. So there shouldn't be any doubt.
I agree.
So.
Yeah, I agree.
And we'll go over this with general counsel on the bifurcation so they understand the proceeding a little bit better since it's accepted nationwide to do this. So,
if the code does say in other places action, then we may want to say in here constitute final orders and action.
Okay.
That way you've covered. So, but take a look at that. Yes. If you think action, throw that in.
Okay. Next one is small in the definitions under hearing officer. The last sentence says, a member of the commission may serve as a hearing officer but cannot have served on the complaints committee.
I don't have the definition.
Hearing officer?
Yeah, something you read earlier made me think you don't have the most up-to-date version.
I have hearing panel, but I don't have hearing
officer.
Yeah,
so that's not.
Well, Kirby, if you can
work. The most recent version is right here.
Okay.
I sent this out on Monday.
Okay.
That's the one you gave me, Kirby, because it was in my book. I'm sorry.
Okay. You get this one. I was looking at the red line one. That was better for me too.
So the red line is two versions old.
Okay. But it's hard to look at this because
I know.
It's not red line.
But it's a rewrite. So the red line was just so useless to me. But you can easily run a red line between the most current version and the current rules.
Okay. All right.
All right, this and hearing officer talks about you. Obviously, if you're going to be the hearing officer, if you have been elected to be the hearing officer for the complaint in ABC case, then you don't have anything to do other than be the hearing officer in ABC case. I mean, that's it.
Right.
So a member of the commission may serve as a hearing officer but cannot have served on the complaints committee, and I think it's clear to say during, for that particular complaint. Do you know what I mean? Just tighten it up, not just at the time of the probable cause.
I get what you're saying. Let me explain to you guys why I did it the way I did it, and you guys can either overrule me or whatever you want to do. The reason I did it this way is, as we know, complaints, as what's defined as a complaint, could be anything from hotline tip through final public hearing, right? That whole time, it is a complaint. It's not a sworn complaint, but it's a complaint. So what this means is if you were on the complaints committee at any time from the first time that the person called Carla anonymously, you're disqualified. And in my view, the important part was you weren't part of the probable cause finding. It's not really about whether you were sitting here and you voted in favor of Carla going out and getting some more information. It's really about whether you were here to vote on probable cause. But I'm open to being corrected on
that. That's not clear to me upon reading that. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't clear to me. So if it's not clear to me with all of my years doing this, I can't imagine that it would be clear to the average. Maybe it is clear to everyone except me. But
they cannot have served on the committee at the time of the probable cause determination. What do you?
Well, see, at the time of the probable cause determination, you could have six meetings determining probable cause. To me, at the time of the probable cause determination is at the end when that particular meeting.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It should be none of that.
You don't want that person to have heard of this at all.
Process. It's the process, not at the. It's just the way it's worded. I think we mean the same thing. The person shouldn't be disqualified because I brought up a tip that then later on developed into a sworn complaint. Once it's the sworn complaint and it comes back to you to pick it apart, then the person can't participate in it from the time it's a sworn complaint. In that whole process, in that whole process, not just at the last meeting where you determine probable cause, which is how this reads to me.
Yeah, that's how I intended it to read, but what do you guys want to do?
And if I may add something, I also raised a question about that to Joe, and here's why. If the whole point is to bifurcate, and it should be truly bifurcated and to be independent, I think it raises an issue for your hearing officer to be perceived not to be impartial if they have sat in on preliminary discussions about the facts and authorized certain parts of the investigation before the probable cause hearing. I agree that of all the functions that the complaints committee serves, probable cause is the most important. I absolutely agree with that. But I think that it raises an issue or gives the appearance of bifurcation. Right, it dilutes bifurcation, and it gives the possible appearance of lack of partiality.
We ought to stick by it, so.
Yes, absolutely.
So at what point does it rise to the level where, freeze, we're going to get a hearing officer here, and you can't take part in any of this?
Until the hearing panel. Oh, well, I don't know. It sounds like you're suggesting that it be from the moment the hotline tip comes in.
Well, you can't do that because...
The hotline tip is mentioned to the complaints committee, you're disqualified.
Yeah, once it comes to the commission. Yeah. Once it comes to the committee.
Yeah. So here, my view is, I like the way it's written.
Why don't you just say that they can't, that nobody on the complaints committee can serve as the hearing officer? I mean, that just makes sense.
That's,
I mean, that's simple.
Let me tell you why that's a problem. So you've got to put in it at the time, because everybody on the commission has at one point served on the complaints committee, right? So you're really talking about
you
had to have been on the complaints committee in an executive session.
I see what you're
where
saying.
This complaint was discussed.
You're thinking what he's thinking is way, because if you know if I come off the complaints commission, I'm on some other committee, and now I can never have sat on the
can never have been on the complaints committee.
The way that reads, you're right.
If you change, so you've got to say at the time the complaint is pending. If you say though the time the complaint is pending, that means from the moment Carla tells us
that's
about the
okay.
hotline tip, you're out for that complaint. And that's fine if that's what we want to do.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I understand what he's saying is that you could never, the way that reads, you could never have been on the complaints committee.
Okay.
That doesn't make any sense. So as
Ellen?
Things change, I don't know how much we've changed. Well, we've changed a lot.
Where are they going?
So
we've been talking a lot about the respondent and making sure that their rights were protected and making transparency. I think leaning towards what Kirby was saying about eliminating somebody from serving as a hearing officer if they have heard part of the complaint in the complaints committee. Not necessarily.
Fair enough. However we want to word that.
Do it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Consider myself overruled.
I'm sorry.
This is what the process is for.
Right.
I promise you, I do not take it personal. If I did, I would have...
Well, this is a lot. You know this thing backwards and forwards.
To get it to this point is... Unbelievable.
So
the
good.
Fact that I don't even want to raise anything because it's so perfect as it is.
No,
but
it's not. So
if you take a look at hearing officer and hearing panel, you have to make the same change for
yes,
hearing panel that's consistent with that, just who did not serve
that's correct.
In any capacity on the complaint committee for that
that's
particular
right.
complaint. So, you know.
I agree. If we're making that change to hearing officer, we should make the same change to hearing
panel. Right. And so nothing else on the definitions, you'll be happy to know.
Will one of you throw up? Propose a change to that?
Yes.
Just the language, because I just can't think of how exactly you'd write it to make sure that you cover what we're talking about.
All three of us will do that as we're working with Cherry on it, so you'll get something that the next draft will be all three of us working on.
And what we're talking about is the person cannot have sat in an executive session at which that complaint was discussed. Right.
Okay. Got it. Now, if you move on to page 8... on statute of limitations.
Rule 2.
Yeah, Fantastic. Rule 2.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, what we had before, which I would argue for our old Rule 2, which is we just used something a little simpler, not as legalese, just saying the time, you know, if you give someone 10 days to do something, how do you count the 10 days? Do you count Sundays, holidays,
yes.
and whatever? So... we used to have what's in our rules now is we use City of Jacksonville business days only. So
what does that mean if JEA is open and you're closed? Or if
typically they're the same. I don't
what if the EEOC or the what is it, EOC is here? So the city's that's what I'm saying is how do you define what is a Jacksonville business day?
The official days that a city
official calendar there is
yeah.
an official city calendar there is
yeah.
Now some of us like the police department and. fire department all to don't go by that, but those are
I'm just saying that this one, excluding last deputy, I think it's easier just to say we're going to go by the city of Jacksonville calendar, period.
Yeah. So it's going to be, if what we're contemplating here is that when we're talking about this, these timelines really only matter once you're past probable cause, right? Because that's the only time, that's when you start seeing timelines. There are a couple deadlines about the recommendation from the Special Ethics Council for the finding of probable cause. There's one deadline in there. But other than that, all the deadlines are in the hearing panel phase. And in most of those, I think you're talking about lawyers. And so what I did here, I literally copy-pasted how you compute time in court in the state of Florida, pasted it into here, and I changed City of Jacksonville. Although it sounds wordy, it's just specific. It says you count just like you would count. So if it's 10 days, it means 10 calendar days. The only thing is if day 10 falls on a Saturday, you go to Monday. And if Monday is a holiday, you go to Tuesday. That's really,
you know what? I'm fine with that. I like the simplicity, but I also know if you get a bunch of lawyers involved that they're going to split hairs on like whether the office was closed or not.
Right.
Or
right. Yeah. Right.
So okay.
Yeah.
The city's business days the way it was written in before. That's what I would.
Okay.
I've been shut down since I've gotten here, so.
It doesn't matter to me. I don't think that either way we're running into a problem.
Good. And there are deadlines before. There are deadlines to transmit the complaint to the respondent. There's deadlines to transmit amendments to the complaint. And that was my concern with changing from the business days to the definition, the legal definition and the rules of procedure, is that I'm not serving a complaint, or Carla's not, our office is not open. We're not serving on the weekend. And so it actually cuts into the amount of time that we have to transmit those complaints and those documents.
It does.
So
I don't like that, and
it's never been a problem before, so I'm not sure why we would change it, but that was the other thing.
Yes. Yeah. Just keep it City of Jacksonville.
I say flip a coin.
You know, I like the specificity that's in the rules of procedure. I like borrowing the wisdom that was put into those rules. Mm-hmm. And so if the result is that the ethics office is concerned that you can't comply with the deadlines with this new definition, Let's extend the deadlines. Let's not create our own definition of computation of time if the Supreme Court of Florida has already created one.
Gotcha. Sounds good.
Talked me into it. Okay, good.
Yeah, we can always go back and do that.
I'll accept it.
No, that's what we've all been overruled. Okay, so B, statute of limitations. We have a really bright thing in here, the last sentence. A complaint that alleges prevention of discovery of a violation. In other words, we have something very strange that no ethics commission in the country has, which is we have a 2-year statute of limitation, but it says, hey, if you know someone covered it up with fraud, we can extend it. And we will always get someone alleging, well, they must have covered it up, it happened 8 years ago. So this says that a complaint alleging prevention of discovery must allege the specific facts, which is excellent. I would just want to add that if it's not alleged, that the director can send the complaint back to the person. You know, in other words, if it's not legally sufficient or they don't have it notarized or whatever, I can send it back to them. I just want it to be clear that I can send it back if they don't allege the specific facts and ask them to allege the specific facts.
I'm fine with that because they have that's under 5A, which is the return of a complaint by the ethics director, and it's reviewable by the complaints committee within 30 days or something. Mm-hmm. So. Are you guys good with that?
Yes, that's good.
Okay, and the rest are kind of short here. But
are you going to make that change?
Yeah. Rule 3, we don't do facsimiles anymore, so I was just going to cross out facsimile and just put filing and serving documents, email transmissions, just because who
this faxes? Is about people serving documents with you, though, not you sending.
I have a fax machine.
Yeah, then that should come out.
That's an issue. You need to get one, Kirby.
We're back in time. And we do not long have one anymore.
Okay, next is on page 10 up at the top, C.
I saw that crossed out in the version Kirby sent, and I said, why would we not let somebody fax stuff in? But not having a fax machine is a good reason.
Yeah.
Okay,
other departments, but I'm assuming we don't want people to serve other departments with our documents.
Ethics director assistants, the ethics director or deputy director
Where
shall provide. C on page 10. We just have to, Kirby and I work in tandem together, so we just, to put her position in there, director or deputy director.
So I wanted, I saw there was another place, and this is just a good time to mention this. There was another place where I saw a proposed change from ethics director to office of ethics, and I just want to be careful. I have absolutely full confidence in Kirby, but you have municipal obligations, and I want to be careful about mixing those two terms.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So this may be one of the times where you're just talking about people calling in and asking for help, where it's fine to expand that. But I just want to be careful about mixing those terms generally.
Yeah, if it's something clearly I have to do under the code, then we have to clearly define it.
It does seem weird for somebody to call Kirby and for her to say, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. You're going to have to call Carla.
And she's not in town. So, all right, and then so we'll make,
that?
We'll make that. And then down on D, this is sort of interesting. So we get a complaint on someone, we have to get it to them. Everybody wants you to get it to them by email.
Where are we here?
D, transmittal of the complaint to the respondent. So this says, we need to get a complaint to someone, fire department official. We need to get a complaint. Nobody wants you to send it certified mail. It takes us like an hour to even find all the stuff to get it out, certified mail. They say, email it to us right now. We want it in the next 2 minutes. They want it that way. This says that they have to put it in writing. Please send this to me by email. We would just add to that, or confirmed by the director. Like I would send something, dear Mr. So-and-so, per your request today on the phone, I am emailing you a copy of the complaint. Because if we ask them to do it, we may not get them to send the email, or they may not want to send it and create a public record from work, or God knows all kinds of reasons. But I think it should be confirmed that they asked for it. Do you know what I mean? So I would have to say, as director, today on the phone at 9:15, you asked me to email you a copy. You know, so we're documenting the exact request in writing, but we're doing it by initiating it instead of receiving it, waiting to receive it from them.
I like that in concept. And by the way, most of the stuff that's coming up, at least the three of us have already talked about. And that's why I have kind of quick responses, because we've already went through these things. And so it's just for you guys to, decide where you fall. The problem on this is you got to be really careful with due process when you're talking about initial service of the complaint. This is the first time that they've received it. And so my concern is a slick respondent calls Carla or Kirby and says, email me that. There's no evidence other than their unilateral email that says, oh, you told me. We go through this whole process. They appeal to circuit court and say they never served me with the complaint. And what evidence do you have? So now you have OGC who's having to defend the ethics commission, right, in court. And now you've got to have a trial and call Kirby or Carla or whoever to the stand who says, yep, they told me on this date and time that they to serve by email. And then you put the other guy on the stand. The respondent says, I never said that. But that's my concern.
Don't they waive it by coming in and being part of all the proceedings, or are they
probably.
Could still?
They probably waive it.
So I don't think that would ever. I think it's more of a convenience thing for us to just say, okay, we're sending it to you right now, instead of them waiting. I think they'll be pretty eager and they'll want to get the complaint, so they would email us right away. Either way, it's going to work out. I don't care which way it goes. I think if we can also confirm it.
I mean, that wouldn't work in court, right? You couldn't serve a complaint like that in court.
You have to have a process of summons and complaint.
Right. But even if they agreed to accept service, they'd have to sign an acceptance of service. You couldn't just send them an email and say, as discussed, here's service of the complaint, to the extent that matters.
Can you use the email function that says...
term receipt?
Oh, receipt request? I always click no on those things.
They have to elect it.
I am convinced from what you said. Some of these things you put in, I didn't understand the reasoning behind it. But, I think if we say send an email and I'll send the response back, it doesn't take us long to do that. And it eliminates that argument that 1 out of 1,000 people could make. But, I mean, someone would make it one day.
I don't know.
Did you email it? This might be too
much work for your office, but email it and then also send a certified letter? No.
We could do that too.
Sort of defeats the purpose of the convenience of email.
That gives you the proof that they got it.
Look, if we got 50 of these in a month, then we might think of a streamlined way of doing it. We don't get in that many that it makes any difference. Let's just leave it the way it is. I'm fine with it.
Let's move on.
But thank you for explaining that. All right, let's see. Delaying service. This is like we are going to transmit the complaint, but we find out that the FBI has an investigation that's related to this. And so we can't serve the person with facts that are perhaps interfering with another investigation. We freeze. We stand down. That's the only reason we delay service, that it interrupts another investigation, typically law enforcement. This says, shall be reviewed by the complaints committee within 45 days and a majority vote. And, you know, we don't have this procedure now. We just say that the chair of the complaints committee, like I call John and say, the FBI is involved. I can't serve this. And we're going to delay service while pending this thing. And we can bring it up at the next complaints committee meeting, but not taking a vote or not trying to do it within 45 days or anything. It rarely happens. It's happened once or twice. But when it does, I think we have to trust the chair to make the call on this and have it discussed at the next committee meeting. But I don't want to be under the majority vote timelines and stuff like that. I think that that would get us into trouble.
That's a good point. I don't know that I like the idea of having it reviewed in some respect. Having a decision to basically not proceed on a complaint made by one person or two people now because you got to consult with John. Maybe we just take that line out and just say at the next meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's reviewed at the next meeting.
Right. There you go.
Right. And no majority vote or anything like that. I mean, review, I think you can certainly overturn the chair or make a motion to remove the chair for a
stupid decision.
Isn't
that what it says? Yeah, reviewed. So there is going to be a vote at the next – whenever the next complaints committee meeting happens – The committee will either vote to agree and continue to delay service, or we'll overturn and we'll say, nope, go serve it. But this happens very rarely. Normally, it's actually an IG investigation, right? Something comes in and IG's looking at it. Or
state attorney, yeah.
Well, and included in that could be the FBI and checks from the sheriff's
law enforcement,
office. Law enforcement. I mean, you might want to put that in there if you wanted to add something that would be a reason to not do that.
I would just – the only thing I'm looking for is to have the right of the committee to overturn that decision explicit. But if you want to say shall be reviewed at the next meeting at which the committee could, by majority vote, reverse the decision.
Could. That's better because I think you're going to find with most of these nobody's going to do anything to interfere
with
it.
We've never had – this has come up a number of times, actually, that's never been a problem.
Okay. So I like it that it is next meeting. And that the committee can decide to affirm or reverse.
That way it doesn't sound like there's this formal appeal.
Right.
Automatic appeal process.
Exactly. That's perfect. All right. Now, the complaints within 15 days of election, we did talk about this. And here's the thing. Let's say there's an election in 1 month. Mm-hmm. And we're running against each other. Yeah. And here's the election. It's coming up. And I file an ethics complaint against you. Now, our rule now says that we just bounce it. You know, we just send it back to the person saying, here's our rule. We're not accepting it. Mm-hmm. The change here is that we hold it and toll the statute of limitations. We hold it in our – now, the problem with holding it is that we can't discuss it because it's a complaint, so we can't discuss it. So here we are. We're running against each other. I file a complaint against you, and I say, I filed a complaint against Ellen. You know, the Ethics Commission can't say anything one way or the other about it. What I'd like to be able to say is we don't accept any complaints 30 days before an election. I don't want them to use the Ethics Commission because – you're like a pawn. And so that's why when you see these provisions, you see that you just reject them for that time period. And that way we are, since there's no active complaint, we can speak about it. We can say, no, we don't accept them. There is no complaint against Ellen. You know, so otherwise we're mum, we can't say anything, and we get used.
You said 30 days, and he says 15 days.
It's 15
what the original rule?
No, it's 15.
It was 15 in the original rules
it's
as well.
It's 15 and 15. That was just a misstatement.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. My only issue was just making sure that the statute is told. Because if we're actually, let's say we're 13 days before an election, and you actually have a bona fide complaint that just happens to be at the end of the statute of limitations, I don't want a complaint to get rejected and then you're outside the statute of limitations. So I think Carla mentioned to me by phone, just clarifying that the complaint could be refiled after the election and the effective date will relate back to the original filing.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, okay.
Are you guys good with that?
Yep.
Good. I'm almost done with my little things. And I know that Cherry and Kirby and I will really comb through this. And anything you've approved, we'll make sure the wording is really tight. I think that may be, let's see. Okay, page 12D, preliminary investigation.
Nice. Skipped like 10 rules.
I got that far.
Say 12D?
Page 12, and it's rule 6D.
Oh, never mind.
Yeah.
He got excited.
Thought it was rule 12.
I know. All right.
Okay, so I find that the complaint is sufficient to invoke the jurisdiction, and then I get together with the chair or the vice chair, and I can commence a preliminary investigation, refer to another agency, or three, if applicable, see Rule 8, prepare it for complaints committee consideration.
The purpose of this, if you remember, was at your request, because the original rules were a little bit unclear about whether the Echo Office can investigate before bringing it to the Complaints Committee. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of this change was to make clear that all Carla needs to do, or Kirby for that matter, is run it by John, or in John's absence, me, and make sure that we bless it, and then you can conduct your preliminary investigation, which means check public records.
Right, which I think you specifically asked for that.
Yeah.
But can I just prepare it also, just not as a self-initiation, just as a direct complaint? Like three, if applicable, prepare it for the complaints committee, not just self-initiation, but...
That's right. So it should just say, or three, prepare it for complaints
yes.
committee.
Yes, yeah. Just take out the Rule 8.
Well, and the if applicable.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, that's fine. Page 13, Rule 7, withdrawal of complaints. About six sentences down, it says withdrawal. This is all talking about someone wanting to withdraw the complaint. Withdrawal shall be requested in writing, signed by the complainant, acknowledged before a notary, stating the facts and circumstances constituting good cause for withdrawal of the complaint or dismissal.
Withdrawal.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just an error.
Okay, that's fine.
What I did, though, so Kirby may have just been about to make this point. There is, though, missing a requirement that the division find good cause. So, and I did that on purpose, although it's a little bit maybe obscure. The complainant, when they're requesting withdrawal, they have to show good cause. Okay. But we can allow them to withdraw even if we don't find good cause. So we could say, well, your request is totally insufficient, but we are going to let you withdraw the complaint. It's just removing it, the requirement is on the complainant that they show good cause, not necessarily on us that we find good cause. It's pretty obscure. But
no, it's good. I like obscure, like people. Between you and Kirby, I don't think we've missed any points here. Okay, skipping a couple of pages.
So much for your line by line.
On that sentence you were on, Carla, under withdrawal of complaints, and withdrawal shall be requested in writing and shall be signed by the complainant, and you struck witness and put in acknowledged before a notary, and so I'm...
That comes from the notary statute.
It does? Okay, so I thought it had to
either,
be sworn.
Under the notary statute, it's either sworn or acknowledged.
Okay, so I like sworn. I put sworn as opposed to acknowledged.
So sworn, and the only reason I noticed is because I actually just became a notary. And so
we're all notaries.
I actually read all this relatively recently, and I was like, oh, I finally get to use this thing I just learned. So
you never knew someone else had known about it as well.
Fantastic.
So.
So it's just different. I mean, acknowledged is basically just the notary confirming that you're signing it. Sworn is actually you're swearing to the facts in the complaint.
Right, right, which I'm is what the complaint. Either. Okay, so yeah, I would say sworn. And isn't it? Does the notary statute also state licensed notary? Are they licensed notaries? No.
Yeah, just notary public.
No. Okay. All right.
So sworn.
Sworn it is.
Okay. So.
Guess one ever.
Notary public might be.
Can't believe I got that.
It's like your second one. Is it my second one?
I thought it was my first. I'm not counting the one with Kirby. You know, she.
If I was just backing Kirby, that doesn't count.
Page 15, rule 9.
Yeah.
I'm going to, you know, just ask for this area for Cherry and Kirby and I to work with this. Hotline tip shall be treated as anonymous unless the complainant agrees to include his or her name. That is in our existing rules. We just picked it up again. I don't think we can treat it as anonymous. It's a public record.
No,
it's not a recorded line, but if someone, like a hotline tip, someone writes us a letter and they write, you know, their name and address and everything like that, I don't see how we can treat it as anonymous if they give us the identifying information. It's a public record. We don't have to use their name a lot, but I mean, if we ever at the end of the case got a public records request, we can't treat it as anonymous if we already have the information. So
that's correct.
That is just something that the three of us will get together and legally. We have not discussed, that's a brand new one. We haven't discussed that one before, but in reading it.
Five rounds, and this is the first time.
Reading it for the 50th time, you know, I see that. Anyhow, we'll come up with a suggestion.
I like that change anyway. Now, that doesn't prohibit a complaint, I'm not even sure if they're considered a complainant, a caller from not disclosing their identifiable information. But if they choose to disclose to you who they are, it is what it is.
You would assume they're waiving that if they do that.
Right. So maybe a way to tweak that and just say a caller may provide a tip anonymously, but whatever information they provide you will ultimately become a public record once.
And we can't protect their anonymity if they tell us who they are, you know. So
but we're going to work on that.
We'll work on that, and then the last sentence there: the ethics director may have procedures to regulate hotline tips and complaints. Just adding the word complaints, because the Rule 9 talks about complaints.
So that would be, but that may allow you to regulate different aspects of how a sworn complaint is submitted too, right?
I'm not talking about
every third Thursday. It has to be upside down.
Yeah.
Green paper.
Complaints.
And this isn't for you, right? This is once everybody sitting at this table is retired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see your point. Okay, I'll just cross that out. I don't care. So, all right, because I'm getting to the end here and I'm getting excited. Page 16C. Where it goes, like this is the investigator is investigating apples, and as he's investigating apples, he discovers orange. Oh, the person didn't declare their secondary employment. We got something else going on here. So as soon as practical, it says, upon receipt of the investigator's report, the complaints committee, obviously you send off a crime to law enforcement, and two, I just wanted to limit it to treat potential violations of the code in the same manner as a hotline tip, period, and leaving out the investigator filing a sworn complaint, because I think that sort of encroaches on their independence if they're filing an additional complaint against the person. It mixes their roles up. If they discover orange when they're investigating apples, then it's a hotline tip. They throw it over to us, and we process it as we do any other tip. And we don't have them under the responsibility of filing the sworn complaint themselves.
So I saw this in Kirby's comments, and I thought it was really good. I agree with Kirby, and I don't think this draft incorporates that if an investigator decides as a citizen to file a complaint, you've just resigned as investigator. But we can't prohibit them from submitting a sworn complaint if they want to. If the rule isn't clear, it should be that you can't be a complainant in any complaint and serve as investigator at the same time. But I'm not sure that removing that sentence here really makes any difference. I mean, if the investigator wants to file a sworn complaint, they may do so, and it will be considered like any other sworn complaint.
But they can't continue being the
investigator. Why is that rule in here anyway? Why does that have to be a whole rule on that? If the investigator finds other evidence of another complaint, why do we cover all that? I mean, it seems kind of odd to cover.
So it was
happens.
That comes from the State Ethics Commission procedures. Right. They actually have a rule on that. And the reason why was some of the rules that they promulgated to effectuate their ability to hear complaints were results of concerns they were getting from legislators. And so it's specifically designed to limit them only to what's in the complaint. The investigator at the State Ethics Commission cannot look at anything extraneous. So if I'm talking to Cherry about a violation of CARLA for committing fraud or lying on her timesheets, and it just so happens that she didn't disclose secondary employment, that's a separate violation. I can't go out and look at CARLA and investigate her for secondary employment unless somebody outside in the citizenry files a complaint on that and a separate complaint's initiated. It's very much designed to limit them.
And we actually went once, and this also, I think there were some tweaks here from the original rules, but in our original rules that Kirby drafted, we actually went a step closer to what you're thinking than the state. So in the State Ethics Commission, they can't even go as far as our investigator can. Our investigator can receive information about other things, but then they're not to then go follow that rabbit hole. I think what Kirby's saying, which is I agree entirely, this is really to prevent somebody from filing a complaint about something that's totally technical, but a violation, right? So secondary employment or something to that effect, and then you go in and you're really using that as a pretext to investigate misuse of position or some crime. And so if they receive other information, they just take it back to the complaints committee, give it to them, and then carry on with their job.
Gotcha. I think I didn't follow something, so let me think out loud. If I'm investigating you, since Carl already got used as an example, and I find out you drank this water and threw it on the ground, you littered.
Mm-hmm.
So it says as the investigator, I should submit this evidence or the facts to the complaints committee as separate report, but I thought I was hearing you say if I discover something and I report it as the investigator, I can't be the investigator anymore.
So
I'm confused.
Yep, so the distinction.
I shouldn't investigate it unless you tell me.
The distinction is between the investigator submitting a sworn complaint and them submitting a report. So what we're doing here is we're trying to make sure that the reason they have to submit a separate report is because once probable cause is found or the complaint is dismissed, the original one becomes public record.
And then somebody might know that.
So let's say investigator is investigating misuse of position and actually finds out that you didn't report second. In the course of talking to you, Carla says, oh, yeah, and I've been working for some nonprofit that does a bunch of business with the city all the time. You say, oh, boy. And so you don't go down into that, but you continue, but then you submit a separate report to the complaints committee and say, she said that she worked for this, could be something.
Okay.
And then it's processed just like a hotline tip.
And I don't investigate that, but if you as the complaints committee tell me to investigate it, then I can. I got it now. I just didn't quite get it.
But you don't have to file the sworn report and have it notarized.
The only difficulty I find in this is when you read it, it seems odd. You know what I mean? The way it's written, and I understand once you explain it to me, I understand it. But reading it, I did this my whole life, and it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But I understand it. I understand. Yeah. After
what would you do though if you were
somebody like you is going to be the investigator? So.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It does. I mean, you can let anybody investigate. I mean, to be an investigator, anybody on the committee could be an investigator. Who knows what their background or may or may not be?
We're going to pick you because you have experience.
Well, and I got friends. I got friends that can do stuff. So, but I mean, I understand it. That makes sense.
What do you want to do with the rule? Just process.
You guys look
it
at it,
how,
Kirby.
Yeah.
Can you look at that and see if you can.
Tweak it.
Make it clearer?
Yeah. And add something about if they choose to file it, then they would resign. They must first resign.
So I think that's actually somewhere else. And so, but yeah, wherever it's supposed to be, I think it's here. So it's actually at the end of E, which is at the top of page 17. It says, no complainant may serve as an investigator while his or her complaint is active before the commission. You probably just take out that last part. No complainant may serve as an investigator, period.
And so just again with the clarification, so... if in the course of my investigation, I discover this thing and I report it per the policy, I'm not the complainant. I'm just...
Right. You haven't filed a complaint.
Here, I found
you
this
just...
out. You need to know it.
Right.
But if it was so offensive to me, if I found out that Carla was kicking puppies and I couldn't bear it and I had to report it to make sure it was
right.
done, then I would have to...
Yeah, and if kicking puppies was a violation of Section 602. But assuming that it is, yes. Basically, what this is saying is by becoming an investigator, you don't lose your rights under the ordinance code to file a complaint.
However,
but you've then disqualified yourself from serving as an investigator.
Right. We'll figure out where to put that, right?
Not if I turn it into the report, but if I swear it and go to the notary and...
Then you're out.
Then I'm out. I got it. I just needed it
yeah.
beaten in.
And I think what Kirby is about to suggest is moving that up to the previous rule, which I think is a good idea.
No, that's wherever
Perfect.
You want to put it. No, I saw Carla flipping pages, and before she moves on, there is something in 10A under the investigator that is similar to what was on the complaints panel and the hearing the hearing panel and the hearing officer in terms of the bifurcation and can they cert on the complaints committee at any time.
I'm just so much less
sentence.
Concerned about it here when you're talking about a member of the complaints committee serving as investigator. But
well, my concern was that the complaint procedures require the investigator to be impartial, and if the investigator sat on any part of that complaints committee, including the determination of probable cause, you're going to have a hard time finding that they're impartial.
But what you're
going to raise an issue.
If you make that change, though, you're effectively, and maybe this is where we want to go, but you're effectively then saying that no member of the commission can be the investigator because you don't want to appoint somebody not on the complaints committee because then you're taking somebody off the hearing panel. And so the only commission member who would be the investigator is somebody on the complaints committee who is not going to sit for the probable cause determination. You know?
You know, I think probably procedurally we should always have an investigator be perhaps like a volunteer friend of John's.
And we don't want to deprive John of his right to be an investigator.
Well, I mean, right.
Okay. The sheriff's office has an integrity unit, and they have all kinds of things I would pick that what you wanted them to do. But all you have to say in here is that whoever is the investigator, if it's part of the complaints committee, and they're excluded from the vote. So
you're okay with them serving in the complaints committee as long as they're not voting?
As long as they're not. I mean, if you're worrying about this bifurcation and all that and you want to be strictly clear, whoever does the investigating and presents a report doesn't vote.
And that's how it reads right now.
Well, it says that they should not serve on the hearing panel. They could sit on complaints and vote on probable cause, and that was my concern.
They just don't
that
vote.
They wouldn't be impartial.
Yeah,
if they were doing that. They're investigating, but I'm also going to find probable cause against you. How convenient.
So there should be they should not serve on the hearing panel.
Right,
And they also should not
vote
at the probable cause determination.
Right.
Yeah.
That's an easy fit. That makes sense.
Will you add that, Kirby?
Yes.
The Inspector General's office has offered to run our investigations if we run into anything complicated. Usually we can handle it pretty quickly. It's one interview or one... But if it's complicated, they've offered to help us because they've got three investigators over there now.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Almost finished on page 22.
Nice.
Ooh, 22.
Wow. That's exciting. Okay, I know exactly where you're going here. Go for it.
Kirby?
I'm sorry?
From page 22.
Okay, great. Sorry, I was trying to make sure
and,
no one was trying to get to the
building. Referral to hearing officer, section 2.
Three.
If you take a look, the hearing panel, like let's imagine we've jumped through all the hoops, we've gotten probable cause, and then it goes to a hearing panel. And you didn't have the hearing panel listen to all the evidence. You actually had a hearing officer. It was a retired judge. They came in. They spent a whole day. They heard the case.
For 3 weeks.
Yeah, 3 weeks. The hearing panel. So then it comes back to the Ethics Commission members after the hearing officer has done his thing or her thing. It says they shall review the reports and recommendations from the hearing officer without deference, as if deciding the matter for the first time. And so this is different than the way the State Ethics Commission does it. They do give deference to it, and you have to actually, you have to show that the hearing officer did something stupid, that they didn't, they weren't relying upon substantial evidence, or there was something. You have to give deference.
Right.
So it was written this way for, this is just so that you understand the choice to be made here. There's the way the State Ethics Commission does it, where they give great deference.
It's actually the way every panel I've ever seen does it. This is, and I put it like this way as a placeholder. I don't have a view on which way is correct, which is probably the first thing on that's come up today. Where that's true. But there are two ways to do this. Just about every panel, State Ethics Commission, the JQC, everybody, gives deference at least to factual findings. And so if the hearing officer sits through 3 weeks of evidence and says, I find he lied, that we shouldn't say, I find he didn't, after we, you know, think about it for 10 minutes. And so most panels would say that factual findings are entitled to deference if supported by substantial evidence. I think that's the phrase. And we can do that or not. The way it's written right now is keeping control. Competent substantial evidence. And so that's the way most panels do it. The way I wrote it, just as a placeholder, keeps all that authority with the commission, so we could look at it and just sort of throw out their factual findings. But I don't have a strong view on which way is right. I mean, every other panel's done it the other way. So
be attacked if we did it differently. Yeah. If we threw it out and said, "Oh, we're gonna just change that finding of fact," and they're gonna go, "What?" And then for sure we'll get an appeal.
We should change that.
Okay.
Change.
You guys add that language that Cherry said.
Yeah, Cherry. Competent substantial Cherry. Evidence. Yeah, we got it.
Competent substantial.
I only have one last thing.
I think conclusions are reviewed de novo or without deference.
Right.
You know, this will probably never happen.
Yeah.
So we're not going to even, I'm not even going to bother with this, but this has to do with a rule on disqualification. And we've never had that happen. So that's going to be in like next year to think about it.
So, but the issue that Kirby raised that Carla decided not to raise just now is the, or actually the, Kirby, you didn't raise this. This came up in earlier drafts.
It was in my comments.
That's right. It was in one of them. But the rules right now, it's all about the legal sufficiency. So if you move to disqualify, the commission member doesn't get to decide whether you're lying. If the complaint, if the request for disqualification is sufficient on its face, you're out, right, under the current rules?
No. There is, under the current rules, it's just legal sufficiency.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So if it's legally sufficient, then you have to disqualify.
Well, it doesn't say either way, but.
But you're reviewing for legal sufficiency. If the request for disqualification is legally sufficient, you have to disqualify yourself, even if you know the facts in it are false. And that is how it works in court, but only for your first request. You only. So if the complainant says, swears under oath that Ellen paid me $5,000 to take on the secondary employment, and therefore she needs to be disqualified from the commission. You've never met this person before.
No.
And but you don't get to decide that. If it's legally sufficient, you have to disqualify yourself.
Dang.
Even if they're lying and you know, even though you've never met them before. Right. And that's how it works in court too, but only one time. Under the current rules, it's not clear what happens on a subsequent request. So do you get to just keep doing that? So then once you've disqualified yourself, and then they say, Joe paid me $10,000, and then I'm gone. So basically, it's saying for the first request, sure, it's legal sufficiency. We're not going to get into whether you're being truthful. But if you try to disqualify more than one member, now we get to look at whether you're actually telling the truth.
Does it make sense to apply two different standards? That doesn't make sense to me. Either you look at the facts of it and that's truthful, or you don't.
In the
original and the other, or you don't. It just seems it seems to be inconsistent. Yeah. It seems to be a little bit.
Hey, I'm all about making all arbitrary. The determinations under D. So saying you get to rule on the facts for all of them, but I was just trying to balance how the rules are now and how this works in court, which is, it is only legal sufficiency. So you get your first disqualification of a judge just based on legal sufficiency. But I'm perfectly fine saying you get to find the facts for the first instance. That's just a really restrictive way of viewing disqualification.
You know, I think it would be so unusual if someone tried to do that, and such odd circumstances that an Ethics Commission member would be disqualified. I'd prefer to have a factual basis for it instead of having them allege something, because that is a public record that Ellen has been charged with this.
Right.
And you never
can. The judge doesn't get to rebut it, or you don't get to rebut it.
You don't get to rebut anything. Yeah. You don't get to say, you lied. Yeah, I've never met you in my life. I think we ought to give whoever is accused of that in the future the chance to say something about
true.
Yes.
Sure.
And would that be my responsibility if somebody alleged that?
Yeah, you said I never met you before my life.
And you're the decision maker of that. No, nobody. It's all about what you believe. So you get their request, which says you paid me $5,000, and you say, I find that's not true, therefore I'm not disqualifying myself. Because the commission doesn't decide, you decide.
I decide.
So that's the balance, right? Is if you do factual findings, then you risk having a commission member that just lies.
A puppy kicker.
Not you, though.
I think I'd rather err on the side of letting the commission member be able to make the factual determination and defend themselves on the record. You guys want us to draft something up on that? That is the last I have. Do you guys?
I have one. It is on Rule 11. Is it? Hold on. Yes, 11B3. So 11B2 says the respondent, this is in terms of, you have two things going on. You get, the respondent gets a copy of the investigator's report under Rule B1 and 2. And then under Rule 3, after the investigator report comes out, the Specialist Ethics Council does it and makes a recommendation to the Complaints Committee about what to do with the investigator's report. Under Rule 2, the respondent gets 14 days to respond to the investigator's report. And under Rule 3, they only get 10 days for the special counsel's report. I think it should be the same. I don't see a reason or justification. In fact, I think of the between the two reports, the most substantial to the respondent in terms of their rights being affected going forward is the special counsel's recommendation.
Right.
So if anything, they should get more time there. Right.
Yeah. Because in reality, I mean, just practically speaking, the complaints committee is likely to follow the recommendation of their special ethics counsel, who's their prosecutor. If the prosecutor says don't move forward, then it would be kind of weird to say, no, you're prosecuting this.
Right. So my recommendation would be to make them the same, that the respondent gets 14 days to reply to both the investigator and special counsel's report.
I'm fine with that.
And our job is to go through all of this and the discussion today and draft up quickly so we can get it out to
make sure that there's no other large-scale things. We talked about, you brought up the fraud or other device. That's helpful. So these are pretty self-explanatory. Oh, there was one thing I wanted to ask. If a motion to dismiss is filed under Rule 12, after a finding of probable cause. So this is on Rule 12B. So motion to dismiss for a lack of jurisdiction after a probable cause finding. It says here that the complaints committee shall meet an executive session to consider. But once it's public record, can we go back to an executive session? I don't think so, right? It can go back to the complaints committee if that's what we want. But I don't think you can have a public hearing and then say, oh, now you guys go decide this secretly and come back to us, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah.
Can we
Good
remove
point.
That?
Good point. My theory that these can never be perfect, that we can give them now to more lawyers on the commission, and we'll find some additional suggestions. But I think we're getting it down to the
master's thesis.
Never finished. But
the first time one of these goes to a full public hearing, we'll be right back here rewriting all
this. I know.
What were we thinking on that rule?
Yeah.
And so now the work, really the ball's in our court for Cherry Kirby and I to get together and hammer out some of the wording of some of these things that you wanted and make sure that it's perfect, and then we'll get it.
You prepared this, Joe?
I did.
Okay, very good. Very good.
It doesn't, I think you may have been before you got here, this isn't every change, but this is intended to cover more than just the material changes. Somebody could read this and say, I think I get the gist of the material changes at least.
Now, do we need to vote on anything? We need to
vote on, right? Is they're gonna
you're gonna review it and then bring it back
we'll come back to the committee or come back to the full?
Full. Don't you think it goes directly to the full? I mean, we're going
to. There needs to be a recommendation from the committee, I think.
Do you want to make a? I mean, you said yay or nay on every single one of these changes.
I'll move to recommend adoption of the proposed amendments with the changes we've discussed today.
Okay.
Ellen will second that.
We'll second that.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. There
we go. Well done. I mean, really, I think this is one of the best meetings we've had because it's not a really the most exciting thing that an ethics commission can do, but it takes a lot to get through it. So thank you, especially to Joe, for getting it to this posture and for the two of you to really kind of delve into it like you did. Thank you.
But you guys have both spent over a full work day with me on this. So this is it's been a lot of work. Do we have to afford public participation here or just?
Yes, here.
So
would you like to, do you have any comments, ma'am? Okay.
Only one.
We have a lot of confusion up here.
Pardon the apples and oranges. That's where I got confused at. But I'll wait till the review come out and then if I can't understand it.
Well, thank you for coming and listening to all this. Thank you. All right. Well, then we'll end our committee meeting. We'll adjourn it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Bye, John.